Good afternoon. Looking back on it, I think it probably would have been better for my presentation to be before Roland's. But I'm going to talk about policy options. This is taking from Deborah Cohen's presentation, where she argued that the food environment makes it impossible for us to regulate our food consumption on our own, and so we'll need to have environmental change. And what I want to do is go through sort of thinking out loud about what are different ways in which we can change the environment to reduce energy consumption through policy change. There's my non-disclosure. So by way of background, obesity is, of course, an excess of energy consumption compared to energy expenditure. And the estimates that I've seen is that the degree of imbalance is a lot less than you might think, that it might, the entire epidemic might be explained by as little as 50 to 150 calories per day. And that's our goal, is to try to reduce that amount. And that's an average, of course, across the entire population. And obesity, we know, is linked to increase in snacking, energy-dense foods, consumption, particularly of sugar-sweetened beverages, an increase in the size of portions consumed, and that our environment encourages those. There's a ubiquity of food, both energy-dense foods, snack foods, and sugar-sweetened beverages. We have larger portion sizes, and we have very high levels of advertising of those. So with that as a way of background, what are different policies we could put in place? So here's the question which I'm trying to answer here is, what policies could reduce consumption of energy by changing these environmental features? And I try to come up with a fairly comprehensive list, although I'm sure I forgot some things, and I'd be happy to hear suggestions from people during the question and answer session or afterwards about important policy suggestions that I haven't included here. I did deliberately exclude schools because that's something that's got a lot of work on right now, so I wanted to look beyond schools. But my list was that I want to generate initially was not considering at all the practical or political feasibility. But then of those policies, I wanted to estimate which have the potential to reduce calorie consumption the most, and then which are the most practical and politically feasible. So the policy approaches fall in several categories. There are what I would call information and media approaches, and you could think of those in food stores, restaurants, and in the mass media. There are economic approaches. There's something which didn't fit well in any other category called government purchasing standards, which I'll explain more in a minute. Restrictions on sales, restrictions on portion sizes, and restrictions on where you can eat, on the locations of consumption. And I'm going to go through each of these in turn and mention a little bit about what is being done on them now, and then try to sum up as far as their potential effectiveness and feasibility. So first, let's take information and media approaches in food stores. There is product labeling now, but you could think about better product labeling. You can label foods with regards to just pointing out the ones that are healthy, the sort of healthy choice approach, which is currently in use in some grocery chains. You could go on the opposite side and provide warnings only. That would be negatives. Or you could do the combination of positives and negatives. Their traffic light labeling is something that's being done in the United Kingdom right now. It's not mandated, but it is encouraged by two food manufacturers as well as the grocery industry. And here's an example here where foods are given a green light, a yellow light, or a red light according to the content of these different unhealthy constituents. There's not a lot of evaluation of these, but there is some evidence that even the very limited labeling on food right now in the back of the package, which is pretty hard to read, that has had some impact on product formulation. Information and media approaches in restaurants include calorie labeling on menus and menu boards. This is something which has been implemented in New York City, in Seattle, King County, and elsewhere. I've sort of lost track of where else it's being put in place. There's not a lot of solid data evaluating this yet either, but anecdotally it does suggest that there is an effect on purchases. And cross-sectional data, when you compare people who see calorie amounts to those who don't, is that it might impact as much as 50 calories per meal, which, again, could be substantial. Then you could think about information and media approaches in the mass media. You could think about advertising restrictions, such as restricting advertising to children, or something broader than that. Or you could think about counter-advertising. You could counter-advertise against calorie-dense foods, or it could be more limited to sugar-sweetened beverages, and this is just one example that we tried a while ago in New Orleans. Didn't stay up too long. Then you could think about economic approaches, such as taxes on calorie-dense foods, And you could limit those to sugar-sweetened beverages, or you could have it be a little broader, focused on energy-dense snack foods. Sales taxes on snack foods are common, and commonly they may be different from the sales taxes on other foods that are healthier, but excise taxes are rare. I'm not sure if they're none of them, or they're certainly far more rare. The studies in general on food suggest that there's a good price elasticity, so that if we do raise the price through taxes, we should see a substantial change in consumption. You could also think about food stamp use restrictions. Food stamps could be used for foods that we'd consider healthy as well as those that are unhealthy. For example, you could prohibit the use of food stamps for sugar-sweetened beverages or for energy-dense snack foods. And then government purchasing standards is something that I hadn't thought about, but the people in New York City have done it. They've established a policy for all of New York City government on government food purchases, cooking, serving, and distribution. The New York City purchases over 200 million meals and snacks per year through schools and daycare centers, and you see that listed. When you think about all the different ways in which government buys, gives, and serves food, it's pretty substantial, and that could drive the market to one degree or another. Then you could think about restrictions on sales in the workplace, things like prohibiting vending machines or prohibiting vending of whether through a machine or through any other sort of food site of specific foods and beverages, or you could have health criteria for workplace cafeterias. You could also restrict sales in non-food stores. This is something that's an interest of mine. This is a Office Depot where you have a nice cooler there with sugar-sweetened beverages and candy. We have a poster out in the exhibit going right now that shows that about 40% of non-food stores in America sell food, usually within an arm's length of the cash register queue. So that could be prohibited. You could restrict the number or the location or hours or practices of restaurants, such as the ban on fast-food restaurants in South LA, limiting the hours of restaurants, banning drive-thrus, or what I think of as a bigger problem is these convenience stores that mainly sell tobacco, alcohol, and junk food. This is what I refer to as the problem of food jungles. There's a lot of publicity these days about food deserts, but in fact, I think that the poor live not so much in food deserts as in food jungles, where there's just an excess of the sort of food that is quite tempting and quite toxic. And this is an example of a convenience store in a low-income neighborhood in New Orleans. And so that could be regulated through zoning or other local mechanisms. If you want to stretch further, you could think about restricting portion sizes in restaurants. For example, you could say that every restaurant can only sell food in what would be an acceptable portion for someone who's on a 2,000-calorie diet. And then if people wanted more, they could buy more, but then they would be aware that they're buying multiple portions. And not much of an evaluation of this, but the laboratory studies do show that, as Deborah mentioned, that the portions people are given are the portions that they eat, and that people don't very much compensate for that, either with the other items that they purchase or in other food during the rest of the day. Or you could even think about restrictions on portion sizes for packaged food, such as sugar-sweetened beverages. When you think about the giant 2-liter containers, 3-liter containers, those are huge portions that people are carrying home. Restrictions on location of consumption. One of the biggest strides, I think, in the tobacco control movement has been smoke-free areas in workplaces or other indoor areas. You could think about food-free zones at workplaces, changing the social norm around the idea of this constant snacking, which is increasingly taking place. So that's a list of policies, again, without regard to practicality or feasibility. What I did at this point was to go through those policies and try to estimate what benefit they might have on calorie consumption. So what I've done here is I've listed off policies on the left. Then the second column there is how many calories per person per day across the entire population would those policies address? So, for example, traffic light labeling in grocery stores would address an awful lot of the food that we buy, because we buy an awful lot of our food in grocery stores. So that's an estimate of 1,300 calories. On the other hand, food stamp use restrictions down at the bottom is something which might address a fairly large percentage of the calories for people who are on food stamps. But when you average that across the entire population, it addresses a much smaller amount, like 50 calories per person per day. The numbers in that column are, they're certainly estimates, but they're estimates that are, have some data behind them, and so I'm probably not too far off. Thanks. Then I try to take it a step further and say, okay, what of the foods that they're addressing, What's the percentage reduction in calorie consumption that we might, or what's the percentage reduction that we might expect based on the policy? And this is a lot more guesswork here because most of these have not been evaluated. In some cases, I had evidence from tobacco control or other fields where I could sort of say, for example, counter-advertising has caused a 7% reduction in smoking, so I could throw a 7% in there. But there's an awful lot more guesswork there. But then when I multiply that third column by the second column, I can estimate the effect overall of reduction of calories per person per day. And because there's so much uncertainty here, I just put it in ranges of 0 to 14, of 15 to 29. And then I put over in the last column there some measure of the certainty that I've got on a scale of 1 to 5. And so none of them anywhere near 5, which is high certainty. They're fairly low levels, but at a range of that. So the first thing you notice here is that all these food policies don't make a huge difference on their own, which suggests that we may need more than one if we really want to get up to the 150 calories per day we want to see the reduction of. This isn't all the policies, though. This is the rest of them that I went through, the restrictions on sales and portion size limits. What I was interested in when I went through this exercise is that the portion size limits appear to have the greatest impact on calorie consumption. Again, because the portion size laboratory studies, we have a fair amount of data that suggests what will happen if you reduce the portion size and people eat less. And so a 10% reduction among the foods that are offered is actually a fairly low end estimate of what the potential impact would be. It could be quite a bit higher than that. But even if you include that, this is up in the 30 to 60 calories per person per day, so fairly substantial. So then I went one step further and said, okay, now listing off all the policies here and summarizing their calories per person per day, and I'd try to score them on practical and political feasibility. And if there was guesswork involved in the previous column, this is total wild guesswork, and anybody here can probably guess as well or better than I about feasibility here. Nonetheless, there are a few patterns here. There's certainly information and media approaches feel less threatening to people, and so they're probably more feasible. Whereas restricting what people can buy or putting some heavy regulation on what businesses can sell is probably going to be less feasible. But there's a couple of things worth pointing out here. One is that, again, if we're looking for the biggest calorie impact, maybe these portion size limits would be the most important one. Nonetheless, those are probably politically very tough for people to swallow. On the other hand, if we're looking for feasibility alone, it suggests that calorie labeling at restaurants may be the way to go. Again, not only does it seem theoretically feasible, but also it's been passed in some jurisdictions, and so it's got some real political momentum behind it. And then sort of in between, we can think about taxes on calorie-dense foods, which would have a medium range of feasibility compared to others on the list here, and medium as far as its calorie effect, and the traffic light labeling that's being used in the United Kingdom now. So to summarize, there are many policy options which we could put in place to reduce calorie consumption. Most of them really haven't been attempted or evaluated, so we're kind of shooting in the dark as to which is going to be the best. There's an awful lot of uncertainty about the potential effect. I think more than one of these policies is likely to be necessary if we really want to stop the obesity epidemic. Those portion size regulation may have the greatest theoretical potential, but the information and economic approaches are probably the most feasible, at least right now. In conclusion, then, I think that localities ought to be trying and then evaluating these policies. I would think starting with the information and media approaches and then maybe economic approaches. And that we should also be doing the sort of laboratory simulations and pilot projects to try to estimate the potential effect of those other policies that are a little bit tougher to put in place right now. Thank you very much.
And our last speaker is Brian Monsink. Where are you again? I can't remember the whole title of your office.
Today I'm from Cornell University.
Oh, you are from